The date is March 30th, 1957. The time, 10:45 hours. This microphone is set up on the west bank of the Suez Canal, and here's the first ship.
As you have gathered, we're... This was to salute the first ship that is passing through Port Said. It is the Krasnodar, flying the flag of the Soviet Union. And all the ships... And all the ships in Port Said Harbor are saluting the Krasnodar, being the first ship in the convoy of nine ships passing through the canal today. And here's the second ship, the Greek Alexis, coming up now.
The vessel whose passage through the Suez Canal we've just heard being saluted was making approximately the 400,000th transit of the waterway since that vital international link was first opened to navigation in the year 1869. Why then all the fanfare? Because it was also the first ocean-going vessel to steam through the canal in 1957, some 5 months after that link had been suddenly and violently broken. What happened between the day it all began and the hour that the first convoy of ships cleared the West Breakwater, leaving Port Said, is the story we are about to tell. We call it The Broken Link.
United Nations Radio presents The Broken Link, a documentary account of international cooperation in the clearing of the Suez Canal. The story is told in the voices of the men who raised the wrecks, the men who supervised the job, UN observers on the spot, and delegates at United Nations headquarters in New York, where the job was planned and organized. Now let us pilot you through The Broken Link.
This is a story about the Suez Canal, one of the many which are being told during the past century. But recent events have added a new vocabulary to the saga of Suez, a vocabulary which includes the words parbuckling.
Turning a ship laying on the side up on the even keel again.
Shear legs.
Shear legs. I repeat, shear legs are floating cranes.
Names of vessels.
They have names from Greek mythology denoting strength, like Titan, Atlas, Hercules. Then there are the vessels with names from the German and Norse mythology, like Wotan and Thor. Some of them have geographical names, like Zwarte Zee, Pol Zee. Finally, names of persons, like Giovacchino and Vladimiro.
Names of men. Here are some of them and their voices. Captain Jan Lolkes.
I am just a chief engineer of the Dutch team which is working here.
Baron de Banfield from Italy.
I asked for a barge, oil barge, because there are 20 or 30 tons of oil in. Yeah. The barge didn't arrive still today.
Well, you will see it floating down to Port Said, I'm afraid.
But I don't want them to get to be blamed, you know.
Captain Matson of Denmark.
We carry with us a lot of pumps, and we got normally two divers on board.
Captain Klostermann.
Well, I'm from northern Germany, from the Danish frontier, but I always felt, you see, a pull towards the sea.
Mr. Leontich from Yugoslavia.
We are very happy to be working here under the United Nations to have a chance to cooperate with salvage teams of other nations.
What is the relationship between these names of men and ships and technical terms and the story of Suez? To tell you that, we must go back in time about half a year.
Certain areas of the world have long been known as powder kegs. Last October, as you'll recall, one such powder keg, the one in the Middle East, caught fire. Israel's forces crossed the frontier into Egypt. Egypt mobilized her troops to counter the invasion, and the battle was joined. Swiftly, the battle area moved westward toward the Suez Canal. The intercountry gunshots sounded alarms in a large complex of buildings on the East River in New York.
United Nations Headquarters, October 30th, 1956. Here in the Security Council, the 11 members are seated around the table. They have invited the delegates of Egypt and Israel to join them. Sternly they sit as U.S. Ambassador Lodge declares,
"We have asked for this urgent meeting of the Security Council to consider the critical developments in the Sinai Peninsula as a result of Israel's invasion of that area yesterday. Certain things are clear. The first is that by their own admission, Israeli armed forces moved into Sinai in force, and I quote, to eliminate Egyptian Fedayeen bases in the Sinai Peninsula, end of quotation. Secondly, reliable reports have placed Israeli armed forces near the Suez Canal."
The Soviet delegate, Mr. Sobolev, leans forward to warn of complications. He reads a press report datelined London.
"Britain and France declare today their forces will occupy key positions in the Suez Canal area unless Israeli and Egyptian stop fighting within 12 hours.
October 30th, 1600 hours, New York time.
That press report is confirmed. Sir Pearson Dixon quotes a statement made in the House of Commons by his Prime Minister. It says in part,
"Her Majesty's government and the French government have called upon both sides to stop all warlike action by land, sea, and air forthwith and to withdraw their military forces to a distance of 10 miles from the canal. Further, in order to separate the belligerents and to guarantee freedom of transit through the canal by the ships of all nations, we have asked the Egyptian government to agree that Anglo-French forces should move temporarily into key positions at Port Said, Ismailia, and Suez. The governments of Egypt and Israel have been asked to answer this communication within 12 hours.
The delegate of France supports this stand, but Egypt's delegate, Omar Lutfi, labels this a Franco-British ultimatum, exposing Egypt to the threat of aggression.
Hours.
Mr. Lodge offers a resolution. Israel and Egypt are to cease fire, and Israel is to leave Egyptian soil. All nations are to refrain from the use or threat of force in the area.
1900 hours.
France and Britain veto the resolution, saying the peril to Suez is too immediate for such measures.
2100 hours.
A Soviet resolution is offered similar to the vetoed one.
2200 hours.
It too is vetoed.
2300 hours, New York time.
It is 6 a.m. next morning in Cairo, and time has run out. The ultimatum has expired.
October 31st, UN headquarters, Security Council chamber.
Mr. Lutfi of Egypt has the floor.
British planes carried out an air attack on the city of Cairo at 7 o'clock this evening. Air offensive by bomber aircraft is at this moment being launched against military objects in Egypt.
Since vetoes stopped the Security Council from taking action, its members found another way to deal with the developing crisis.
My delegation formally proposes that an emergency meeting of the General Assembly be called.
Yo espero que el solo el anuncio de una asamblea tenga la influencia moral bastante.
We do think that this resolution is clearly relevant, clearly applicable in the present circumstances, and we shall therefore.
La vía adecuada sería la convocación de una asamblea extraordinaria de emergencia.
We hope the assembly will be held.
November 1st.
The General Assembly meets in special emergency session. Urgently, it surveys the critical situation.
November 2nd.
The Assembly calls for a ceasefire.
The days pass. The fight goes on. The Assembly meets morning, noon, and night. November 4th, another call to ceasefire. Finally, on November 6th, at midnight GMT, the United Kingdom and France order a ceasefire. The British and French by then occupy the northern quarter of the Suez Canal. Egypt has the rest. But what about the canal itself? The canal was closed. For the first time in 87 years, except for 4 days in 1955, when a huge tanker, the World Peace, had accidentally been wedged in the El Fardan Bridge, the canal was tightly closed. From Port Said in the north to Port Ibrahim in the south, many wrecks of many sizes and shapes lay sunk athwart the liquid lifeline between the two world's oceans. What did it look like? Taki Andriadis of UN Radio was there, and by shortwave from Egypt, sent this verbal picture.
The scars left by the recent hostilities on the 103-mile Suez Canal include sunk tugboats, cranes, dredges, barges, vessels, and bridges. One of them is the wrecked Sirdan Bridge, some 40 miles south of Port Said. Another important obstacle is a landing craft loaded with cement and sunk across the canal a few miles...
Meanwhile, at UN headquarters, the Assembly was still in special session. As part of its resolution of November 2nd, the Assembly had concerned itself with the broken link. It was, in fact, Secretary of State Dulles who had proposed that resolution, part of which we hear in his voice.
The General Assembly, noting that traffic through the Suez Canal is now interrupted to the serious prejudice of many nations, urges that upon the ceasefire being effective, steps be taken to reopen the Suez Canal and restore secure freedom of navigation.
With these words, the job is defined. But who will do it? Britain and France volunteer. Egypt objects. On November 7th, the Secretary General said he would seek a salvage fleet from countries not engaged in the Suez conflict. Britain and France, however, go ahead with salvage in Port Said. November 8th.
The Secretary General approaches Dutch and Danish firms which agree to assist in clearing the canal.
Some 2 weeks go by. The Secretary General, in a visit to Cairo, is asked by the Egyptian government to provide United Nations aid, as a matter of priority, in clearing the obstructions from the Suez Canal as soon as non-Egyptian forces leave the area. November 20th.
Back at headquarters, the Secretary General reports to the Assembly, now in regular session, on his contacts with salvage companies and asks authorization to proceed.
November 22nd.
The Assembly hears pleas for speed. Prime Minister Bandar Anayake of Ceylon declares...
Not only for us, but for so many other countries, Western as well as Asian, it is important that the Suez Canal be cleared as early as possible.
November 23rd.
British Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd tells the General Assembly,
this is an immediate and urgent task. It's in the interests of many nations, African nation and European.
November 24th.
The Assembly gives the Secretary General the green light, and negotiations for the clearance operations begin. In the press area at UN headquarters, a voice announces over the loudspeaker to correspondents...
Attention, please. Here is the text of a statement by the Secretary General on the appointment of General Wheeler. Quote, I have arranged with the President of the World Bank for the loan of General R.A. Wheeler, engineering consultant to the bank, to assist me in the technical organization of the work on the Suez Canal. General Wheeler served in the United States Army as Chief of the Corps of Engineers from 1945 to 49. End of quote. I'll repeat it. I have arranged with the President of the...
The same day, the Secretary General requests the Dutch salvage firm of L. Smit & Company and the Danish firm of Z. Switzer's Salvage Company to dispatch to the canal such ships and equipment as have been put in readiness in various ports and to contract for other craft as needed from salvage concerns in different countries outside the conflict.
November 26th, the fleet took shape. From the icy waters of Scandinavia to the sunny Adriatic, even south of Suez, the salvage armada grew. An armada whose ships were armed with cranes and lifts, with winches and pontoons. They had come from Copenhagen and Gothenburg, through the Kattegat and the Skagerrak, like the Odin, the Sugain, and the Tor. They had come from Hamburg, down the North Sea and the Channel, like the Ausdauer, and the Energia. From Rotterdam, ships called the Svartzee, the Atlas, and the Condor led the parade. From Antwerp, the Titan joined the fleet. From Italy and Yugoslavia, ships like Hercules and Veli Joje put to sea. From Aden on the Indian Ocean, the Danish craft Protector turned west, then north. Slowly, all these ships converged upon the isthmus.
They had their work cut out for them, these vessels of many flags. Of Denmark, Holland, Sweden, Germany, Belgium, Italy, Yugoslavia, flags which were replaced by the blue and white pennant of the United Nations when they went into action in the Suez Canal some days later. Meanwhile, the calls for speed grew more insistent. Back in the General Assembly, it was November 26th.
Every day that passes without effective action to complete the opening of the canal imposes additional economic burdens on the trading countries of the world. The last estimate that has reached me, and it's from a most authoritative source, is that the total cost to all countries of the stoppage of the canal could easily reach a figure of $250 million a month. Surely this most impressive figure underlines the urgency of the task of clearing the canal.
That was Foreign Minister Richard Casey of Australia. December 4th, General Wheeler and his staff, including surveyors from Smit and Switzer, reach Egypt and set off to inspect the job ahead of them.
As the December days unfolded, smudges appeared on the horizon off Port Said. They grew darker as the hours passed. Observers on the shore saw what first looked like tall spars of sailing ships, which then resolved themselves into lifts and booms and tackle. December 21st, the first ships dropped anchor at El Cap, a quarter way down through the canal. Now that canal was blocked, of course, by sunken ships and dredges, by bridge spans and car ferries and the like. But not all the vessels within its 103 miles were at the bottom. 15 of them, 13 in one place, 2 elsewhere, in transit when the hostilities began, were still afloat, but tightly trapped. This is what they looked like to Andriadis.
They are now lying idly in the middle of the desert, forlorn and silent. As you approach the canal from Ismailia, you suddenly see their masts and funnels, and then their hulls sitting on top of the sand dunes like a mirage in the middle of the desert.
December 28th. The UN salvage teams begin their work. They started that day in the south, and as the year ended, the UN fleet began operations in the northern sector. Ships were dressed down for the job, booms were unlashed and cables threaded. Winches hummed and donkey engines snorted on assorted decks. The sound of air compressors rose, and bubbles danced up to the surface as divers went below. Torches bit into the steel of sunken ships and the twisted girders of the bridge of El Fardan. Camels splashed, but not the grumpy quadrupeds. Camels are also hollow cylinders. Filled with water and submerged, they're attached to the wreckage on the bottom. Then they're pumped out, and with growing buoyancy, strain and lift until the wreckage breaks water, covered with slime and marine growth, with green foam spilling from the decks. Men worked mightily day and night. Whenever the task required it, they pooled facilities and skills among each other, and on occasion with the Egyptians. Up and down Suez they worked. Wreck after wreck began to rise, some intact, some came in pieces to be scrapped.
And back at UN headquarters, the cable room echoes with progress reports sent from the scene by ticker.
January the 2nd, Tug Ardent, wreck number 15, lifted and floated by United Nations salvage fleet.
January 4th, east span of El Fardan Bridge, wreck number 30, lifted by United
January 4th, Tug Kirsch, wreck number 16, lifted and floated by United Nations salvage
fleet. January 6th, Tug Agile, wreck number 16, lifted and floated by
How do you go about lifting these tugboats here at the harbor?
Well, first, of course, the diver goes down to investigate how the situation is, how you're lying, if it is possible to put a strop through the propeller frame. Mm-hmm. If we can put a strop through that, and then we can lift the tugboat a little bit and put the other strops under it. And with those strops, we will be able to lift this kind of tugboats. Mm-hmm. Then we put the pumps in, and then the pumps do the rest, you can say that.
The day came when the 13 trapped but intact ships were freed. Andriadis watched them come to life again.
January 8, 1957. First to steam up was the L.A. Knutsen, a Norwegian tanker. People swarmed down to the harbor, waving and applauding. We were all anxiously following her gracious movements through the narrow channel. A few more minutes, and she was free, steaming up in the blue Mediterranean. 20 minutes later, the biggest tanker of them all, the Statue of Liberty, flying the flag of Liberia, passed through in great majesty. This was the most breathtaking passage, and she just made it through the narrow channel. The rest was easy. One by one, the ships passed with an interval of 20 minutes or so, and steamed out into the free seas again.
January 31st, another progress report on canal clearance, this one by shortwave circuit from Cairo.
This was an ordinary day in the 103-mile-long Suez Canal. At kilometer 40 south of Port Said, UN salvage vessels were refloating a capsized bucket dredger. At kilometer 81, two huge floating cranes waited patiently for the end of dredging operations before lifting a sunken ship. the Akka. But there is still a lot to be done. In Port Said, 6 wrecks remain. 2 dredgers, 1 big bucket dredger, the Pelise, the salvage lifting craft Pollux, an 80-ton floating crane, and the Greek merchant ship.
On March 1st, that 80-ton floating crane came up from the depths. At the scene of operations,
we are now on board the Veli Jože, a Yugoslav lifting crane. Actually, it is called a shearlegs in technical language. And she is about to perform a very difficult operation, which is righting up, or parbuckling, a sunken floating crane of an 80-ton capacity here in Port Said Harbor. The operation is now underway. They started a few minutes ago, and they have succeeded in raising the floating crane quite a bit, but she's not turned yet. They still have to go on lifting the other side of the sunken floating crane, which is underneath the water, and pull it up and righting it before they float it outside of the harbor.
As you can hear in the background, the Yugoslav salvage men have put the pump into operation. The pump is pumping water into the 80-ton floating crane. You can hear now the cranes of the Veli Jože working in the background. They started lifting very slowly one side of the floating crane. Some bubbles are coming out from one side. Now the wrecked floating crane is sinking slowly. She has come to a point where the open holes on top are now being filled with the seawater, and she's sinking rapidly, and at the same time, of course, turning slowly upright. Well, this is the most important moment of the operation. Slowly, slowly, very slowly, and steadily. That was a stick of dynamite they put on the wires. And there she goes. She's uprighted. The silt's running down from the upper structure. And there she is, uprighted.
Meanwhile, throughout the weeks, more reports had come by ticker.
February 14th, LST, Akka, wreck number 33, lifted by U.N. salvage fleet.
February 18th, Tug Atlas, wreck number 39, lifted and floated by United Nations.
February 20th, Freighter Zamalek, lost parts of wreck, lifted by U.N. salvage.
March 3rd, Bucket Dredger number 3, wreck 36A, lifted by United Nations salvage fleet and dumped in Great Bitter Lake.
March 4th, Suction Dredger Louis Perrier, wreck number 26.
Andriadis and his tape recorder were present as the Louis Perrier broke water.
We are aboard the Dutch shearlegs, or floating crane to you, Arend, about 54 kilometers south of Port Said, on the bypass opposite El Balla. We are witnessing a very interesting operation, the refloating of a big suction dredger, the Louis Perrier. Well, this is the story in brief. You can hear in the background the pumps working, pumping water out of the Louis Perrier, and it is estimated that it will take one day to pump the water out and refloat the Louis Perrier completely. At this point, I'm seeing one of the Dutch crewmen here on a rowboat who is passing around a bottle of liquor and cigars and cigarettes, celebrating the refloating of the Louis Perrier. General Wheeler and his staff is aboard the Veli Jože on the other side of where I'm standing now, and he is looking pretty happy in his black Hamburg hat, smiling with his sunglasses, and he's waving at us now.
Congratulations!
Yes, he looks very happy indeed. And the crew members of the three shear legs, I repeat, shear legs are floating cranes, are all very happy to see the achievement of their efforts here before their eyes. Well, here's General Wheeler now, and let's see how he feels. Good morning, General Wheeler.
Morning.
How do you feel, sir?
Fine. I suppose you want me to tell you what I think, how it's going.
Yes, sir, well, please.
It's going splendidly. It's something that, to me, is most thrilling, and I've certainly enjoyed seeing the operation.
Thank you, sir.
The weeks marched on. The work went on until only two major wrecks remained to be removed. The large tug, Edgar Bonnet, right in the canal, near Ismailia, and the frigate Aboukir at Port Suez. The world's attention focused on those two ships as General Wheeler awaited permission to get to work on them.
Meanwhile, in the General Assembly at UN headquarters, political efforts centered on obtaining Israel's withdrawal from the remaining positions her forces held in the Gaza Strip and at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. Came Friday, March the 1st, and Israel announced its agreement to withdraw.
On March 25th, after 12 days of underwater work on the Edgar Bonnet by UN salvors, Andriata shortwave from Cairo this dispatch.
The Edgar Bonnet, the only major obstacle remaining in the Suez Canal, was lifted today from the bottom of the waterway near Ismailia. The operation was performed with great speed and success by the Dutch salvage team of the UN Clearance Group. In less than an hour, the Edgar Bonnet appeared almost completely out of the water, full of sea growth, silt, and mud, but otherwise undamaged.
The sole remaining obstacle, the frigate Aboukir, was raised from the bottom 2 weeks later. On that day, the 8th of April, General Wheeler made this announcement to the world from Cairo.
The Suez Canal is now completely cleared. I take great pleasure in making this announcement. The United Nations Suez Canal clearance operations are now completed well ahead of schedules. We have beaten the estimates, which were mid-May for clearing the navigation channel and the entrances to the canal, which are now restored to full width of cross-section. Flying the United Nations flag, 31 vessels with 450 men from seven nations, whom I had the honor of being in command, were able in less than 4 months to clear the 41 obstructions. The job was not an easy one. We met with many technical difficulties, which only a United Nations team of men who are among the best salvors in the world and a complete set of the best, the most powerful, and the most effective equipment that exists today could have overcome and have completed the job in such a short period of time compared with the size of the task. With the men and the equipment, there was wonderful international cooperation. And above all, the real spirit of the world today, the United Nations spirit.
At once, the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Hammarskjöld, cabled the following message to General Wheeler. With the lifting of the Aboukir, you have achieved the last major step in the UN responsibility for the clearance of the Suez Canal. For this task, which has been done so magnificently with great expertness and speed, you, your staff, the Dutch and Danish salvors, and their subcontractors have my heartiest congratulations.
And so ends this account of the United Nations clearance operation in the Suez Canal. Once again, the harbors of Port Said and Port Suez resound to the whistles and sounds of passing ships, for the broken link has been restored.
You have been listening to The Broken Link, a documentary account of the clearing of the Suez Canal, produced and transcribed by United Nations Radio. Your narrators have been Gene Kern and Vincent Tovell. Actuality material from the Suez Canal by Taki Andriadis. Written and produced by Irving Berenson, this has been another in the series of documentary programs coming to you from United Nations headquarters in New York.